I remember hearing stories about Yahoo. They were just laying so many people off that at one point they called, I'm sure this is another one of those rumors, they put the wrong people in the wrong room, and they had like 100 people in like one of the conference rooms, like not like 75 people in one conference room. And that was supposed to be the stay room versus the fire room. And they told the wrong people the wrong thing.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Ad Tech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce, and we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From double click to double verify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
So this week we make good on the promise of the second half of our introduction, where we say from double click to double verify. We've already had two Kevins from DoubleClick on the program, Kevin O'Connor and Kevin Ryan. And today we're delighted to welcome the CEO of, you guessed it, DoubleVerify, Mark Zagorski. Mark is a prolific ad tech leader. Over the years, having headed up Telaria and Exalate, among others, and his pedigree goes back to the pioneering agency, Moda Media, Poppy Tyson. So we like to start with a random personal question that isn't really that personal, but what was your dream career when you were a little, Mark?
When I was in college, I wanted to be in the music business. I desperately wanted to work for Spin Magazine, believe it or not. That was I thought it was the coolest place to be, and I would do anything there. And I actually, on a trip to New York City when I was in college, I actually snuck into their office and got past the receptionist and dropped off a resume on one of the director of marketing's desk. And I never heard from them.
Were you in a band, Mark?
I was not, but I did some DJing in college and stuff like that.
Was it mostly metal in your case?
A lot of new wave, alternative.
The Cure, Depeche Mode.
Yes.
So what was your first exposure then to MarTech and AdTech and the media world?
I ended up taking my first job in the fashion industry. I worked at J. Crew as a marketing analyst. So I got my MBA and was a marketing analyst and like basically helped them figure out where to send catalogs, really exciting stuff. So it wasn't really fashion, I would say. It was catalogs.
Direct mail.
But I like to say fashion, it sounds cooler. I worked at J. Crew Group for a while and then ended up going into the actual apparel business, into like the fiber business. And I promise you, gets to tech at some point. I was a brand manager at a fiber company that like we made ski clothing and like snowboard clothing and all this stuff. And one day my boss comes in, he's like, we need one of these websites. And I was like, okay, sounds cool. Let me figure this out. And he's like, here's a course. Go take this class on websites. And like, this is back in like 95, 96. And they actually would have classes you could go to and be like, learn about this new thing, the internet. It was like the Learning Annex or one of those places. And I took like a 5-day class, and it was about using like Mosaic and FTP and all this stuff. And I came out of it, and the story I always tell is like, they handed me a booklet at the end. They're like, here's all the websites in the world today that you need to know about. And it was like, you know, 80 pages long, and it was thick. I'm like, oh my God, look at all these websites. There's like 3,000 websites that you can go to. You know, it was like amazing. So I was hooked at that point. I got into tech. I hired an agency to go out and like work with me to build the website. And we built the first divisional website for the company I was working at. And
wasn't that basically Yahoo's idea? They were going to make a list of all of the links of every website they could find.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
The rumor is you were at Moda Media, Poppy Tyson at some point. How did that happen?
I was. The agency I actually, our traditional agency for my job was Bozell, and they were handling all of our print media and all that stuff. And they said, well, we have this division called Bozell Interactive, but they're like, they share a space with this other company called Poppy Tyson. You should go talk to them if you're looking for someone to build your website. I ended up not using them to build a website, but I made some contacts there. And I'm like, this is really cool. Like, do you have any job openings? And they're like, well, Bozell Interactive doesn't, but this upstairs, if you go upstairs to Poppy Tyson, they're in the same building. They're all in the same building. They're sharing the same thing. Like, there's this, you know, Poppy Tyson has a lot of jobs open. You should go talk to somebody there. So I literally like walked upstairs after a meeting with Bozell, like from there, I was pitching them their business. They were pitching me their business and met with some Poppy people. And they're like, yeah, we're doing this. We have this division, we're called, it's Poppy Tyson Interactive, which became poppy.com, or started at poppy.com, then became PTI. And they're like, yeah, we need people tomorrow. When can you start? And I was like, really? And they're like, yeah. Well, and I had like two interviews and they're like, that was when they could not hire people fast enough. It was insanity. We were like a division of Poppy Tyson, and Fergus had like said, we're gonna spin off this division because Interactive is different. We start with 40 people and we were something like 300 people a year later. They were just hiring random people. Like, I swear to God, they're on the street going, do you know any computers? Come on in.
Wasn't that Interactive division called DoubleClick?
DoubleClick was one, and that was the one that they ended up actually, I'm sure you talked to Kevin and I listened, like he put a nice sheen out. They kind of kicked DoubleClick out because they were like, you know, we don't think there's any value here. Yeah, the fit doesn't work. So we're going to have this other, you know, we have this Interactive group over here that's going to build websites, and that's where the money is, building websites.
That was Poppy.com.
Yeah.
So what did you actually do there?
Sorry. I was an account executive.
You're in sales.
Yeah. So I came in and I managed all the, like a big group of accounts. And I was like the senior person there. I was 28, I think, at the time. And they're like, you're going to be a group account director because you're 28. Like, you're old and you're going to run all these accounts. And they just handed me, because they were winning accounts hand over fist. I mean, it was super successful. They're like, we just won, you know, the Morgan Stanley business, and we just won HSBC, and we just won, you know, all these banks. We had IBM. They're like, we're going to put them all under you, and here's your team. And I was like, okay. And we had Chase. First of all, it was back when like you could have total competitive conflict everywhere. We had like Chase and HSBC as clients, leading banks. We were managing all their stuff. And we had we got a Standard & Poor's portion of their business too. And it was like, they throw these accounts where they're just like, go manage them. I'm like, what does that mean? Like, there was no onboarding. There was no training. There was nothing. It was like, here's your clients. Here's a team. We're building these websites for them. So go at it. I was like, okay.
Figure it out. So that starts to answer the question about what the culture was like there. Can you talk a little bit about the culture and about Fergus O'Daly, the obviously legendary founder?
I was too far down the food chain to spend a lot of time with Fergus. I spent a lot of time with some of his deputies. So there was a woman named Sherry Sidlick, who was the president of the company. Fergus was the CEO, a guy named Sean McKinsey. But it was pretty freewheeling. Like, Fergus was like... I would see Fergus emerge and he'd have these like legendary like St. Patrick's Day parties in the office. They would start at like 8 a.m. and there was like miniature golf course set up through the office. I mean, it was definitely like, if there was a Mad Men era to like Interactive age, that was it. I mean, it was, like I said, we were hiring people left and right. There was office romance going on everywhere. There was no accountability from an HR perspective. It was truly a free, like, craziness. It was, but it was fun. And we pulled all nighters. Like, this is like, the people are pulling all nighters. Like, we have a client meeting with Standard & Poor's tomorrow. We don't have a pitch done. Everyone would stay up all night and like walk into Standard & Poor's the next day without sleeping. I mean, stuff that just doesn't happen today. You'd be brought up in front of like an EEOC panel for half the stuff.
I love it. Can you talk to us a little bit about how, you know, advertising was really kind of bought and sold in those days? And you were, you know, you working with websites. So how do you get from websites to ads?
Poppy Tyson was really focused on kind of web development. We built some content management tools, and they hadn't really got down the notion of buying and selling ads. It was only after they merged with Modum that Modum really, that was their bread and butter. Like, Modum was an ad sales business, right? They knew what they were doing. And I think it was actually a pretty smart merger on paper, which is like, hey, we have these guys that have really big clients building websites. And then we have this really smart company that's selling ads, like, pull them together. And like, we build the website and we sell the ad against the website. Let's do it. You know, when we saw that come together, the selling of internet ads was literally like selling newspaper ads. I mean, I have to remember those days. It was like, okay, you're going to buy a spot on the page. And it's just like, I think they would like take a tear sheet out of like the New York Times ad sales book and just like change the names of the, you know, of the ads and be like, oh yeah, this is how you buy them. This is it. We just like, CPMs were still kind of confusing. So it was like, oh, you buy an ad on the homepage for, you know, $500.
The price.
Yeah, exactly. What does that mean? They're like, it's $500. That's what you get. I don't know. That's what you buy. We'll track it and we'll see what happens. But it was, you know, so early, like no one knew really how to measure anything at that point.
How did you go about tracking in the early days?
I mean, there were some tools, like a lot of the tracking tools were actually built into the ad servers, right? So there weren't a lot of, there wasn't independent measurement. It was kind of like, oh, well, the ad server said you did this. And then we'd compare it against a log file that the client would get, you know, that the publishers would give. And we'd try to map everything together and figure it out. It was not very accurate nor very independent.
What were some of the industries that were real interested in ads at that time?
Like it came from a lot of like, how do we're never going to sell a phone, you know, even though cell phones were through the internet, but what we can do is we can get a lead. So there was like a lot of lead generation, that sort of, so companies that were looking to build lead bases. I remember we had one client, MCI System House, which was like a B2B, like telecom company. And they're like, we're going to do a ton of advertising because this is the way we're going to get like CTO leads. That's what they were trying to get. It's like, they were running ads to get CTO leads. Like, are you a CTO? Then, you know, click here, you know, and that was the ad, you know,
or
click here. Yeah. A lot of it did work. People are like, oh, you're talking to me. How did they know I was a CTO? Well, you know, we're running an ad on CTO.com. So that was the first, indicator. We really didn't have any behavioral target or anything. It was kind of like pretty much buying a newspaper.
How were click-through rates in the early days?
I think those rumors have been exaggerated over the years because I've been part of that story. We're like, the click-through rate of the first ad was 78%, the first AT&T ad. And it's like, you know, I think that's great. It's just been that, you know, the Whopper story that's gotten bigger and bigger.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
I do remember, you know, when we really started measuring click-through rates over time, looking at, like, there were double digit, like 10% click-through rates that were normal. Like, that's what people were expecting. And I think because, again, a lot of the folks that even came from Poppy Tyson, remember, Poppy Tyson was a B2B business, and they did a lot of direct mailing. So they were using kind of metrics that they'd expect from a direct mail campaign that they would send to a B2B kind of company and say, oh, can we get a 5% fill out card rate on something? And that's what they looked at. So those were expected by clients. Like, we expect a 10% click rate from an ad because that's what we get, you know, on a direct mail piece that's targeted to a certain audience.
But the CPMs on digital must have been a lot lower than direct mail.
But no one really knew, like, okay, well, how many impressions am I really getting? They're like, I don't know. There's not really good measurement. And until like ad serving really became robust and then third-party tracking came in, like, those things started to play a role in it for sure.
So you ended up at a company called World Now and then MediaSpan. What was that era of the Mark story?
The dark years. Those were my years of trying to transform local media into digital powerhouses. And going into a local TV station in Louisville, Kentucky, and trying to literally convince them, like, hey, everything you're doing is going to disappear in 10 years. And they're like, yeah, right. They're like, you know, that was when TV, think of like the late 90s, early 2000s, like TV was booming, right? Like they were making so much money from like car dealers and all of these local, like, it was like a huge thing, right? There was that, and especially in the local space, local and regional advertising was still really big. So TV was booming. You know, we came in, we're like, now all this digital stuff is going to change what you do. And we would literally have like general managers of station groups come in and be like, I'm going to tell you right now, this internet thing is a fad. I'll never forget it. It was like, it was the head of the CBS owned and operated group. And he's like, this is a fad. I'm telling you right now, no one's going to do this. No one is going to watch. First of all, no one's going to watch video, because just remember when video players were on your laptop. You're like, no one's going to watch a newscast on a computer someplace in a 4x4 box up in the corner, right? That's not the way people watch news. They're never going to do it. This is dead. You're wasting your time. And, you know, that was the response we usually got. And then it became, all right, well, some people are doing it, but, you know, we make $20 million, you know, a month in revenue. Well, it's probably high for a local TV station, but we make $1 million a month in revenue from, you know, our auto dealer ads. And you're going to tell me to take a salesperson and sell a $5,000 banner on the homepage for the month? They're like, I'm not wasting our time. So they would give away all their, we would like build these, the whole idea behind World Now was like, we build these websites and we would own half the advertising inventory. They'd own half the advertising inventory. And then we would go out and jointly sell it with them. So we actually at one point had hired 47 local salespeople, like regional salespeople in these different TV markets that would go out to market and try to sell banner ads in conjunction with like TV ads. And they would just like put our guy in a corner, like literally put him in a closet someplace at the TV station and be like, that's the internet guy over there. Just tell him to give him everything for free. Like we had no idea, like with the contracts we did were all messed up. And they're like, so they'd give away half of our impressions for free and wouldn't support it. It was a very tough slog. But I mean, look, it was the right model. It was literally like 20 years ahead of where it should have been, which was like,
all sounds like you're ahead of your time. Yeah. Was MediaSpan in the same space?
Yeah. So I made the smart move to go from TV into radio and newspaper websites because they were much more advanced at that time. But it was still media. It was media, working with like local newspaper groups and radio stations. So we did audio streaming and we did, you know, local like software, content management and software systems for local newspapers as well.
It sounds to me like you were on the road a lot. Am I right?
Yeah, I did a lot of, I spent a lot of time in hotels where the doors opened outward into the street, not to a hall.
Those are called motels.
Yes, yes.
During this time, there's obviously the dramatic dot-com boom, the dramatic dot-com bust. What was your experience of that?
Yeah.
Did it have any impact on your life?
Oh, a huge, because I mean, that's when, you know, I was at World Now, we had raised a whole bunch of money and, you know, it was, we couldn't hire fast enough. We were getting some traction. It was exciting, boom, boom, boom. And for me as a leader, as a young leader, it was like, we have to make this thing profitable or we're done. Like it literally overnight, it wasn't how many people you could hire, it was how many people you could fire and still to keep the wheels on the machine. I remember we went in like in one day, we were probably, I don't know, 200 people or something like that, or maybe a little bit around that number. And literally like the bubble burst within a week, we're like, we need to lay off 100 people. And we called 100 people into the office that day and we let them all go the same day. And they're like, okay, we're going to make this work with 100 people. And I can tell you though, from that point on, the company was a much better company. We became EBITDA positive within a year. We lived off of significantly less money than we'd ever, you know, had lived off before. And it taught me like at the end of the day, you know, there's all this fun and stuff, but there's three buckets. There's like what comes in, what goes out and what's left. And if there's nothing in that third bucket, you don't have a business, you have a charity, right? I mean, I remember hearing stories about Yahoo. They were just laying so many people off that at one point they called, I'm sure this is another one of those rumors, they put the wrong people in the wrong room and they had like 100 people in like one of the conference rooms, like not like 75 people in one conference room. And that was supposed to be the stay room versus the fire room. And they told the wrong people the wrong thing. But they had fired like, and they were, this was like 75 percent, they were firing like hundreds of people over the world, but they had like actually fired the wrong 75 people and they had to call them all back in and be like, no, we made a mistake. You're okay. And they told the other people that they fired them. So yeah, there was a lot of, that's like, again, going back to, there was a lot of 30-year-olds who were the top person in the company who or division who were, didn't have any experience doing this stuff.
Yeah. Where was your headquarters?
Yeah, New York the whole time. I've always been in New York.
Get your name out there.
When I first encountered you, you were at Exalate, which was kind of a data platform and did behavioral targeting and then also DMP eventually. How did you end up at Exalate? What did it do exactly?
When I look back at decisions I made, that was probably the most defining decision in tech that I'd made in my career, which, you know, yes, kind of jumping brand management tech was important, but it was a real flyer. Like I met these two really smart Israeli guys. So a recruiter called me up like, you know, he tried to explain to me what they're doing. They're like, they're going to be doing like, you know, do you ever hear of a company called Takoda? I'm like, yeah, Takoda's like, yeah, well, they want to build a marketplace of data instead of selling the media, but just like, think of how programmatic media is bought and sold, but like, they want to do that with data and they want to make a data exchange. And you got to meet these guys. I'm like, I don't really understand what you're talking about, but I'll meet them. And I met the two founders, two Israeli founders, Iri Zohar and Elad Efraim, met these two guys and they were so smart. I was like, oh my God. I'm like, I don't understand what they're talking about, but there's something here. Like I could feel that there was something there that was really intelligent. And I was like, and they're like, I'm like, why do you need me? And they're like, we're really good at this building stuff and smart stuff, but we need somebody just to go out there and like help us sell it. And that's what I did. I came in as a CRO for the first couple of years. And then as the company evolved, I became the CEO and, you know, was the CEO for 5 or 6 years until we sold to Nielsen.
Where was that initial meeting with the founders? Where did it take place?
Coffee shop someplace in Midtown.
Were they waving their arms around?
Yes, there was a lot of waving of arms and drawing. It was really, I mean, at that point, the company it was like five people. They had like two engineers in Tel Aviv and, you know, like product manager, and the CEO was still in Israel. The CTO had moved to New York, so he was here. And they had successfully exited another company called Sidor, which was like an ad network. So they were familiar with the space and super, super smart guys and had built the infrastructure for something that was going to be pretty incredible. Blue Kai came out right, like we were actually to market first. And this is another good learning example of where better marketing and bigger VCs can make a difference, right? They took more money and they had more connected VCs. We had Israeli VCs that at that point weren't as connected into the US ecosystem. And they just spent more. They're like, we're going to market this. They kind of like fake it till we bake it. We're like, no, we're going to build like a really good system and wait until, you know, it's right before we really push and market it. And I think the marketing muscle won there. They ended up exiting for more than we did. They got some of the bigger clients. But net, the first thing that we kind of framed it around was this idea of delayed ads. It was like, you're going to serve an ad, but then, because at that point we were like dropping pixels off the ad to collect data from the site. And it was retargeting. So the first data that we collected was from almost retargeting. So we'd drop a pixel from the ad, use that to feed it back into the system and allow them to then use that to not just retarget the user, but build a segment around it, right? So if you targeted a certain number of publishers, we'd drop a pixel on that publisher and then build a segment around travel publishers or something like that. That was the first day. So it was like, we called it delayed ads because the first ad you run isn't going to be the targeted one, but the next one you do once we use the cookie will be. It emerged from that into then there started to become a narrative around behavioral targeting and data around that. And basically then it was kind of like, it was almost like a bring your own data idea. Because Dave at Takoda was doing like, hey, we're going to run a behavioral marketplace, but we're going to sell you the ad, right? And we're going to target it for you. We were like, hey, you can take your own data. You don't have to buy the ad from us because we don't sell the ad. We'll just give you the data and you can use that on, you know, one of these cool new platforms called the programmatic platform, which is really how, like, we initially had started selling data to like ad networks. If you remember the ad networks, like we would sell them data and we'd have licensed the data to an ad network. But then when the company really hit stride is when, you know, I met guys like Joe Zawadzki, who was launching MediaMath, and we met Jeff Green when he was at AdECN, and they're like, we're starting these new programmatic platforms. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the perfect place for data. Like ad networks, the data got stale. I'm like, you're telling me you're doing a place where people are bidding and I can send you fresh data in real time, you know, via this cookie ID, and you can insert that into the bid stream and start targeting against it. And that's when our revenue started popping, because it was like people were just going in and checking boxes saying, use XLA data on this impression. We'd update it. And the results were right there. And that's when the flywheel started happening, is when the DSPs really started kicking off.
Yeah, I remember that. There was kind of a drop-down menu. You could pick, you know, Blue Kai, you could pick XLA, or in different parts of XLA segments. So you could be in market for something else. Automobile. It was very easy.
We also learned the lesson of why every company 50 years ago in the phone book was called AAA Auto Parts or AAA. Yes. Blue Kai came ahead of Xlate. So when people were scrolling down the list, they're like, should I use a Blue Kai auto segment or an Xlate? It's like, oh, B first, just click on that. Whatever was first on the list.
Well, at some point, you also had a DMP. I remember you sort of morphed a bit or added a DMP. What was the strategy there?
That actually came as part of, it was interesting because it ties into the Nielsen part of the story. As we started pulling data from larger and larger partners, so it started off with just taking publisher data, right? So we'd cut a deal with Travelocity, or we cut a deal with AutoBuyTel or something like that, and we pixel their site and they give us data and we create segments out of it. But then more and more data companies said, like, hey, I want to get in on this game. I'm Nielsen. I have, you know, Nielsen Catalina data. I have all this Nielsen Prism data. I want to sell that too. Like, people want to target against that digitally. Can you guys help me sell it? I was like, yeah, we have a big marketplace. And they're like, oh, no. We're not going to sell our data in your dirty little marketplace. We want to have our own control and storefront. So our back into a DMP was really, when we started talking to folks like that, they're like, we want to have control and manage our own data through our own platform. And we may sell it through your marketplace, but we're going to control what gets sold. We want to build the segments on our own. So what we basically did was take the core of our marketplace and spin it backwards into almost like a white label tool set so that the big data companies could manage it on their own. And that was kind of the birth of our DMP.
I think that's how it worked for BlueKai as well. They started with a data marketplace and then they backed it to a DMP because their customers were asking for it, essentially, because you had to build it for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, A, we were starting to make them a good amount of money, right? So they're like, whoa, we're sending all this money. Because remember, back then, we had kind of a hybrid model in many cases where we would pay for a DMP, or we could give you the DMP and you give us a piece of the revenue that comes out of it, right? So Nielsen was doing really well. They were selling a lot of data through our pipes and it was a pretty successful run. And I think number one, they said, this is a pretty good business. Maybe we should own it. And I think number two, and I think this is still valid today, they saw this thesis around big data versus panel data, and how can we merge the two together? And we, at that point, we were seeing a lot of data, right? We were seeing a lot of individual users. You know, this is before there was a ton of regulation around PII. So we were capturing a significant amount of like identity data, a significant amount of device data, and we knew device IDs. We had you know, browser recognition, all that kind of stuff. And I think they saw that as an opportunity to look at, when they look at measurement in a holistic fashion, bringing a big data aspect to it. So I think it was those kind of two things, like, A, it's a good business in itself that we're making money off kind of targeting data, but how can this play into the bigger thesis of by looking at census level data that we had on consumers, you know, at big scale?
Yeah, that makes total sense. How did that lead you to your next venture? Is that how you ended up leading to Telaria?
Yeah, it definitely led me there, because after Nielsen bought the business, I determined that I never wanted to work at a big company again. And no offense to the great team at Nielsen and some really great leaders I worked with there. It was just, you know, running a 200 person company versus on our own versus being part of a 40,000 person company was just not.
It's funny that it's a common theme on this program. You know, the entrepreneurial spirit comes out and it doesn't seem to fit in the big company environment.
I mean, you hear the word soul sucking a lot, and I'm not going to say that, you know, that it isn't, but it was. You know, it's hard. It's hard going from, you know, hey, here's our vision, let's hire these people, to, oh, I have to fill out this form to get another engineer. So yeah, I left because it was time for me to get out of a big company, and I saw, you know, at Telaria, which was at that point Tremor Video. Okay, you have these things coming together, which is big data, digitization of all video, and this emerging CTV platform. And Tremor at the time was really the only player out there that was focused on video only, that had a platform that could emerge in the CTV space. And I think, you know, it was super attractive to me in looking at that business. We know we had some things we had to take care of, but there was this opportunity to build it into a CTV business. And that's what I went in to do. We had this thesis where, you know, and it was the whole driver behind turning Tremor into Telaria and what we talked about in the marketplace, which was, you know, all linear TV will become digital, and all CTV is going to become ad supported, right? And all ad supported is going to become programmatic. And we're at the end of that tail, which is basically, if you believe that the mobile business and the display business are 85% plus programmatically bought and sold advertising, then why wouldn't CTV follow that same track? Look how you watch traditional TV a few years ago. Today and a few years ago, you have local TV that you get for free. You have you know, some ad supported television that, you know, which is ad supported, it's free, but then you pay for an HBO subscription, right? That's your Netflix. HBO equals your Netflix, and ad supported TV equals, you know, your ad supported CTV, and that you create a portfolio of viewing, and no one, you know, is, and we get this like elitism around what people will pay for no commercials. Guess what? People have been watching linear TV with commercials for, you know, 75 years. They're going to watch CTV with commercials, and they do. And you see platforms like Pluto emerging. You see, you know, Hulu with ads generating more revenue than, you know, Hulu subscriptions, you know, on their own on a per user basis. You know, all these things show that there's this mixed model around CTV that creates a ton of opportunity for advertising, and that advertising will be bought and sold programmatically.
And finally, Mark, what does Double Verify do exactly?
Our drive is to make a stronger, safer, more secure digital ecosystem. And we do that through creating a verification process between a buyer and seller of digital ads. So we ensure that when an advertiser is in an ad transaction in digital space, that that ad is delivered in a brand safe environment, that it's devoid of fraud, it's actually viewed by a human being, and it's delivered in a geography that's legal for that product to be sold or aligned with where that product can be delivered.
Are you saying robots don't buy products after they see an ad?
Robots neither buy products, but they are very good at clicking on impressions.
And can Double Verify scale with the growth of CTV? You're applicable in that environment too.
Yeah. So we've launched several CTV products, and we've, you know, it's interesting. We talk about fraud. And one thing that's been consistent in my career is that, you know, there's not a lot of new ideas. There's just ideas that continue to evolve. And the funny thing around fraud is the same fraud that we saw in the display world, the same type of fraud we saw emerge to mobile, and now we're seeing it in CTV. So whether it's domain spoofing, right, where someone creates a domain that looks like a real Roku domain or a real, you know, a real Disney domain, or someone create fake apps, which we saw in the mobile business. So apps that actually are not real CTV apps that someone downloads on their television that run in the background. Like, it's all the same stuff. It's the same things. Thank you. CPMs and CTV are now, you know, $30 to $40. Fraud, and that's why the fraudsters are there. It's like, hey, I can rob a bank filled with dollar bills, or I can rob a bank filled with $100 bills. I both have to carry out a bag, right? And I both can get shot by cops, but that bag filled with $100 bills is a lot more worth it. So we've seen, you know, a lot of fraud being targeted towards CTV just because of that.
We would like to thank Julia Douglas for letting us use her music, juliadouglas with two S's.com.